composition by Mal Waldron called Fire Waltz featured were Eric Dolphy and Booker Irvin on reeds, Mal Waldron at the piano, Ron Carter cello, Joe Benjamin bass, and Charles Persip drums from the album The Quest on Prestige Records. In the studio with me is Mal Waldron himself. He is, of course, a pianist and composer. He has been playing professionally since the 50s. He played for about 3 years with Charles Mingus's band, then left the band to become Billie Holiday's accompanist from about 1957 till her death in 59. He's played frequently with Max Roach, has led sessions with Eric Dolphy and Ron Carter. He left the States for Europe in 1965 and has been living recently in Germany. Mal Waldron, it's a great pleasure to welcome you to Fresh Air this afternoon.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Let's start off in the present. You've been living in Germany for how long?
12 years.
What brought you to Germany?
Well, it was a question of economics, because Germany has more jazz clubs than any other country. And in Europe, they have a jazz club in every major city in Germany, while they don't have that in France, and they don't have that in Italy or any other country in Europe. And also, Munich was centrally located in the middle of Europe, so it's very easy for me to fly there. 2 hours by the plane will get me all over Europe.
How well known are you there? I understand that in Japan, there was a note in Billboard a few years ago that you were one of the top 10 commercial successes as far as booking arrangements went in Japan.
Yes, that's very true. In Europe, I'm very popular, too. Very popular, yeah.
Mm-hmm. How do you like coming back to the States for evenings like tonight when you'll be playing the bride?
Well, it's fantastic. I love it.
Okay.
Yeah, it's like coming home.
You studied classical music at Queen's College.
That's right, yes.
And I feel, listening to some of your compositions, like there's a definite classical feel there, but it's never the kind of pompous, well, I'm going to combine jazz and classical music and, you know, make like a more important kind of music or anything like that. It's so perfectly fitted together. How can you talk a little bit about how that kind of education and formal training has affected your jazz composing?
Well, I started off playing classics on the piano. When I first started playing piano, I was with classics, and I started with Bach and Beethoven and Brahms and people like that, and Chopin. And that music, I heard it as a child often in my home, too, because my father used to like the classical music, so he always played classical records on the machine. And that left an influence on me, and it comes out in my music today.
Was there ever a period in your career when you felt you had to, like, make a choice between being a classical pianist and a jazz pianist and composer?
No. I knew I wouldn't be a classical pianist, because classics call for a certain kind of discipline that I didn't have, while jazz is more free. Jazz is, I could play me when I played jazz. I couldn't play me when I played classics.
You started playing with Mingus in the mid-50s?
1954.
What kind of leader was he for you to work with? That was pretty early in your career.
Very, very inspiring type of leader. He showed me things about the piano that I wasn't aware of at that point, because he was a beautiful pianist, and he showed me how to use the piano, to use the complete piano and not just stay in the middle of the piano as I was doing up to that point. And he showed me about clusters and using my elbows on the piano and things like that.
Using your elbows on the piano?
Yeah, well, anything goes. The piano is an instrument, and you got to get music out of it, so if you knock on the wood or anything, it's all part of the music. It's all valid.
What kind of leader was he to work with? I've heard all kinds of stories about his temperament as a leader.
Well, he's a Taurus, so that means he's very impetuous. And it can lead to violence, but it didn't lead to violence in my case, because we were like brothers.
Well, what made you lead the group? I guess there's always that point where you have to decide whether you're going to stay or go when you're with a group.
Well, Billie Holiday was a chance for me to move into another area of music that I hadn't been in before. I hadn't played for too many vocalists up to that point. And I was interested in accompanying a vocalist, and as great as Billie Holiday was, I really look forward to that.
Well, I want to talk about your work with Billie Holiday, but I want to save that for in a few minutes. Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about the sessions that we spent some time on Fresh Air listening to, the sessions featured on your Quest album with Dolphy and Ron Carter on it, all compositions of your own. How did you start playing with Dolphy and Carter? How did you all get together?
Well, I met Dolphy and I met Eric Booker through Max Roach, though I played with around 1960. I think it was 1960 when I got with Max Roach. I'm not quite sure, but I think it was around that time. And I met Eric and Booker on dates that Max had. And it was an accumulative thing. You know, you played with one musician and you met another one, and then you went into their groups, and then you played with their groups, and you met another musician, you played with his group, and it just snowballed like that. That was the way music was in those days. No one played with any one band.
Some people seem to have really missed something that Dolphy was doing. Ted Kirson had mentioned that when he first pulled out his bass clarinet in Mingus's band, Mingus said, put that away and don't ever take it out again. Miles Davis had some pretty insulting, I think, things to say about Dolphy early in his career. What did you think about his work when you
I thought he was very very inspiring and very fantastic. He worked like a demon, because it seemed as if he knew he was going to die, that he didn't have too much longer to stay on this earth, so he wanted to finish up what he had to do. And he worked with that kind of concentration. He was always practicing on his horn. And same thing with John Coltrane, too. He always had the horn in his mouth. Even during intermissions, he'd just keep it in his mouth and practice in the back room. And then when the set started, he'd come out with the horn in his mouth and play the next set. Continuous application to the music.
On the compositions on this Quest album, Ron Carter plays a lot of cello, sometimes bowed cello. Mm. Did you have an influence in his playing of the cello as opposed to the bass?
No, I don't think so. No, I think it was his choice that he wanted to play cello, and I used him on my date.
I want to play another one of your compositions featured on that album that we play pretty frequently on Fresh Air and always seems to elicit a lot of phone calls. It's a piece called Warm Canto, which finds, of course, you at the piano and Eric Dolphy on clarinet. Can you say a few words about this composition, which really knocks me out?
Well, all the compositions on this album were written in one night, you know.
No, yeah, they were written, can't believe that.
They were written all in one night. In fact, it was a rush order for the date. And I stayed up all night and I wrote all the tunes, and I tried to make them as varied as I could. And when I got to Warm Canto, I decided I wanted to make the feeling of warmth, the warm of summer, and the Indian summer kind of feeling, you know, the warmth and the cool, in the perfect weather for me, which is perfect weather for me.
Okay, well, let's hear it. This is Mel Waldron's composition, Warm Canto. Thank you. Mel Waldron's composition, Warm Canto, with Mel Waldron at the piano. Well, let's talk a little bit, Mel, about when you left Mingus's band and started working for Billie Holiday. How did you meet up with her?
Well, as it happens, she was playing in Philadelphia at the time, at the Pep's Musical Bar, and her pianist, something happened to him. I don't know whether he got sick or something, but anyway, she needed a pianist, and Bill Dufty, who had written a book with her, was my friend, and he told her about me, and he called me up and told me to get to Philadelphia as soon as I could, and I got there as fast as the train would take me, and I arrived at Pep's, and I met her, and we went on the set. Very nervous, of course. I was shaking like a leaf.
You hadn't had any time to rehearse.
No time to rehearse, but I was familiar with her records, though, you know, so I just went on there and faked it.
What was it like to play with her? Because, I mean, it was kind of playing, I guess, you weren't used to, having played with a band as opposed
to
a vocalist, which is...
Yeah, it was a different area, completely different area for me. But she was so relaxed and so helpful that it went smoothly.
What did you learn from each other musically?
Well, I don't know what she learned from me, but I know I learned plenty from her. I learned to be aware of words when I'm playing ballads. Because the words help so much with the understanding of the ballad and to phrase it, you know. And I learned how to play behind the beat, too, the way she sang. I learned that kind of syncopation.
How did it affect your playing to play with her, who was always singing melody, but she sang so much like a horn. I mean, there was a certain freeness to her phrasing that very few singers have ever had.
Yeah.
Is it limiting for you when someone else is always like singing that lead except for the
spaces? No, it's not
limiting.
It's not limiting at all, no. In fact, it opens your mind up. It opens your mind up to the possibilities of music. You realize that it doesn't have to be 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. It can be 6, it can be 5 fittings over 4, it can be 3 fittings over 4, it can be 4 fittings over 5, or anything like that. All these things are possible and valid in music.
What was Billie Holiday like at the time you met her? You played with her from 57 to 59, the time of her death, and she was, I guess, pretty sick at that time. Or recovering.
Well, she had some good days. There were some warm days, and there were some bad days, too. Yeah. Coming on the end, there were more weaker days where she could hardly stand.
Was that at a time when she had a cabaret license, when she was able to play
most
clubs?
No, she didn't have a cabaret license at all. No. She didn't have it till she died. She never had a cabaret license at the end.
So the places that you could play were pretty limited.
That's right. There were theaters in New York City and out of town. Out of town we could play clubs, but in New York City we couldn't play any clubs.
Let's listen to a composition that you wrote for her.
Mm-hmm.
It appears on an Arista record that was recently issued in the States called Blues for Lady Day. It's all your piano work, songs that you associated with her. Do you want to say a few words about this composition before we hear it?
The Blues for Lady Day?
Yeah.
Well, it's just the blues, and it's just a kind of reminiscing of her feelings as I remember them.
Okay, this is Mel Waldron at the piano, his own composition called Blues for Lady Day.
Thank you.
Mal Waldron at the piano on his own composition Blues for Lady Day from an album of the same name on Arista Records. Well, we have been talking about the past and who you've played with in the past. Let's get back to the present again. You've been living in Germany, you said, for 12 years. There's, you were telling me, a lot of successful jazz stations and jazz television programs Germany
yeah,
now.
Yeah, many. Mm-hmm.
I guess that puts jazz musicians in a fairly different place than they are here, because here, if you play nothing but jazz in your commercial station, for instance, you worry about not being able to make it commercially.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's not like that in Europe, though.
So I wonder, is there like a commercial form of jazz like there has become here? I mean, there has, a lot of jazz players have been playing what is more commercially viable so that they can be assured of making a living, you know, jazz rock kind of music.
No, it's not like that in Europe. You can play what you want to play. You play your way you feel and make it in Europe.
Who have been your
influences?
Major influences, both at the piano and as a composer.
Well, Duke Ellington was my first influence, and then came Bud Powell, and then came Thelonious Monk.
You
Those
were
the three main influences on my music.
You were telling us before that every one of the compositions on The Quest was written in one night.
That's
which
right, yeah.
I'm still recovering from that statement. But, you know, I mean, I think of composers like Ellington, who had incredibly prolific output, maybe in part because he was always having to come up with more material. Did that help you, you know, that kind of structure of, like, knowing you had to get it done?
Oh, yes, it helps you, sure, because if you're, it's like a rat who's against the wall, you have to fight back. can't go through the wall, so you have to fight back, so you have to make these tunes up.
Does that happen to you frequently, that you're in that pressured situation?
It happened to me frequently in when I was in the United States. I had to make these dates. For instance, when I was house pianist at Prestige for about 2 years there, I was making three albums a week, and I was writing music for all these albums.
My God.
Yeah.
So you did nothing but compose.
That's right. Well, no, I played on the dates, too. I played a sideman on the dates, the Gene Ammons dates, the two trumpets and two saxophones and two and four saxophones and the interplay albums, things like those, I was always writing all the music for.
Is there always music spinning around in your head?
Yeah, still, always. In fact, everything inspires me. Even when I was coming up on the train today from Philly, I heard some new melodies in my mind coming through.
Well, maybe we'll be hearing them on an album soon.
Yeah.
Have you been playing with any younger musicians? There's a few leaders who always seem to like pick up on the most brilliant of the young musicians who are coming of age.
Mm-hmm. I haven't had a chance to play with any of the younger musicians, no. I like them, though.
Uh-huh. Mm. Do you listen, do you go to a lot of clubs listening?
I hear them on recordings, records, yeah, most mainly. And some of the clubs, whenever they come by Europe, I hear them.
What is, doing the most for you monetarily, you know, like money from your dates, from your albums, your compositions? I'm sure, you know, on the whole, it all works together. But,
yeah.
You know, is there any one of them that really helps a jazz musician, you know, the most?
Well, my gamer money is and my prestige royalty money are help me quite a lot, too. I get about $2,000 every 3 months from prestige royalties alone.
That's great.
Yeah, and I get more from Gamer, which is the collection agency in Germany, comparable to BMI or ASCAP here, that collects all your radio royalties and earplays and also whenever an album is pressed in Europe, you get money from that, even though it's not sold, you know. You get money from that automatically, just by it being pressed.
I guess that's not the case here.
No, it's not the case here.
Have you seen a change in the other ideals or the workings of record companies in the States over the years?
I'm not aware of the workings of the state recording companies, because I haven't been here for that many years.
So when you record something that ultimately gets released on Arista here, how much control do you have over that? Being that you're
no
in
control,
Europe,
no control over that. No control. That's handled by the record company in Europe that sells the rights to the American company. But I get my royalties coming through GAMA, which collects all over the world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. We haven't at all touched on the films. I didn't mention before that you've scored for three films, one of which was Shirley Clarke's Cool World. The other was a French film. I don't recall the name of it.
Three Bedrooms in Manhattan.
And that showed in France.
That's right, yeah. It showed in America, too, I think. Had Annie Girardot in there. And Maurice Ronet played the roles, too.
Is that a different trip altogether? Doing music for a film?
Well, yes, it's much more disciplining than playing jazz because you have to write music by the second. You know, you write 3 seconds of warm music and then 2 seconds later it changes into violence and 5 seconds later you have the resolution of it and things like that. So it has to be timed very exactly to work out with the movement on the film.
Do you enjoy that? Would you like to do like a big major commercial film sometime?
Yes, I would. Sure. It's very, very satisfying work for me, yeah.
How do you see your own style as having evolved over the last few years?
Well, I think I'm getting more freer at the moment. I'm trying to lean towards more freedom in my music.
What do you mean?
Well, I'm getting away from chord changes and from the form of the tunes, the AABA form of melodies and things like that. I don't play those type of melodies too much at this time.
Do you think that like your classical training set up a form, like a structure, a musical structure that you're now leaving?
Yes, that's right, yes. Actually, the classical form was much more free than the jazz form.
What do you mean?
Well, the jazz form up until free music came in was consisted of 32 bars or a 12-bar blues, and that was it. And you worked within these confines over and over again. You just played on the changes of 32 bars and 12 bars, and you repeated the changes over and over again. You made your variations on that. In classical music, you had much more variation, and you had themes that weren't consisted of 32 bars. Like, for instance, the Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, for example, is not 12 bars long, not 32 bars long. It just goes da 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 da, and it develops, and it goes and it moves out into space, you know, with just the idea of the rhythmic factor. So it was much more freer than jazz.
How free or far out has your playing ever gotten?
Well,
I mean, because there were periods in jazz when, don't you think, when all some people still play this way, when all sense of structure is completely more or less ignored or bypassed.
Well, my freedom has gotten to the point where rhythmically it's still there, it's still in, but harmonically it's out, and any note goes, any two notes go against each other. It clashes and things like that. They're valid now in my music. It's just rhythmically still there. It's rhythmically still swinging, I hope.
We are about out of time, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. We're going to be listening to Zapata, one of your compositions on your new album, Signals. Mm-hmm. Do you want to say a few words about this piece before we hear it?
Well, Zapata is dedicated to Emiliana Zapata, the Mexican, and that's about it.
Okay, well, we're going to hear it now. I'd like to thank you, Mel Waldron, for being here this afternoon on Fresh Air. Zapata, a composition written and performed by Mal Waldron and featured on his latest release on Arista Records called Signals. Again, Mal Waldron will be appearing at the Painted Bride Art Center this evening with two shows at 8 and 10. The Bride is at 527 South Street in Philadelphia.